Hello and welcome back to the 3 a.m. Mystery Club podcast. I'm Brandon, and if you don't have anything nice to say, come sit by me.
I'm Rowena, and I was into Bridgerton way before Netflix found out about it.
I'm Derek, and I'm not paying $1,000 for a cameo by Lara Voorhees.
So her cameo is really $1,000, right? Wow.
He screen grabbed it to me at what, like 5 a.m. this morning?
I was not even looking for her. I was just looking at Cameo and it said it was $1,000.
That's crazy. So Rowena's up again tonight, right? You have your case ready to go?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Well, let's get to it then. But remember, there's going to be something after her case, like always. We're going to do the True Crime Time Machine once again, so stick around.
All right, gals. So tonight's case is set in Alaska in 1982 aboard a salmon fishing boat. How's that for starters?
Very Alaska.
Yes, very Alaska. So on the surface, it may not sound as tantalizing as the torso murders from my last case, but I promise you, it is pretty juicy.
Nice.
Like the salmon.
Exactly, like salmon. It's juicy and full of vitamins. Commercial fishing is one of the top three industries in Alaska, and the three-month salmon season in the summer is one of the most lucrative fisheries. In the 1970s and 1980s, when salmon prices were at their highest, 3 months of hard work could earn a captain and crew of a fishing boat $500,000 or more.
Damn.
Yeah. Let's go into that business.
Right.
A crew member on a salmon vessel can make good money, but the work is hard and the hours are long. Crewing on a fishing boat is a job for young people willing to work and ready to play on those nights when the season is closed and their boats pull into port. One such crew happened to belong to Mark and Irene Holthurst. This young couple was only 28, not even 30 yet, and they already owned their own state-of-the-art fishing vessel, the Investor. They had recently purchased it solely out of Mark's previous earnings. It cost $750,000. They had a crew of four, all young men, ranging between the ages of 17 and 19. And they were such a close-knit crew and family that they even brought along the Colthurst children, ages 4 and 5. And what happened the weekend of September 5th, 1982? Is a crime that will haunt Alaska to this day. It is still unsolved. The small southeastern Alaska town of Craig has a population of 1,200 people and is a seemingly quiet fishing village until fishing season, when you can guess all these people are coming in and they want to spend their earnings on their one night in port. You can imagine, you know, all these sailors converge on this small town. What kind of reminds me of spring break in Florida, if you will.
Yeah, a lot of seamen.
Yeah, lots and lots of seamen.
Sorry, I could not resist.
Wear your rubbers, people. And I mean boots.
Yes.
I don't.
You go bare feet, right?
Singing in the rain, are you?
Sorry, continue.
All right, so here we go. So on Sunday, September 5th, 1982, the Investor, a 58-foot vessel owned by Mark Colthurst from Blaine, Washington, pulled into Craig, Alaska and unloaded its recent catch of 77 pounds of salmon onto a Holbeck Seafoods tender, which is like the cannery. You know, he's going to buy it and sell it to the cannery to manufacture. Mm-hmm. The catch from just a few days of fishing was worth $33,000, but the cannery couldn't pay Colthurst for this or his other catches of the summer until the end of the season. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game had temporarily closed the commercial salmon season, but planned to reopen the following day for the final salmon opening of 1982. Mark Colthurst, the crew and passengers on the Investor included Mark's wife, Irene, 28, their two children, Kimberly, 5, and John, 4, Mark's cousin, Mike Stewart, 19, a crew member by the name of Dean Moon, 19, Jerome Keown, 19, and Chris Heyman, 18. It should also be noted that Irene was 3 months pregnant. After unloading its catch, the Investor pulled up to the North Cove dock in Craig, and the crew tied the boat outside the vessel known as the Decade, which was in turn tied outside another vessel known as the Defiant. To get back and forth to the dock, the crew from the Investor had to climb across all these other boats. So it was like the Investor was on the outside and they were using these other boats as a bridge. And this is important to note when it comes to what eyewitnesses saw. Moon and Keown went ashore soon after the boat docked. According to troopers, the two men later bought a small quantity of drugs from a friend named John Kenneth Peel. Peel had been a crewman for Mark Colthurst on a previous boat, but he was now crewing for someone else. While on shore, Jerome placed a small call to his brother. A small call. I don't know how a call can be small, but he placed a short call to his brother. And his brother later stated Jerome sounded normal, but didn't indicate anything was wrong. Stewart and Heyman left the boat together, but the troopers could find no one in Craig who remembered seeing the two men that night. Stewart called his home in Bellingham, Washington, and didn't mention any sign of trouble either. Mark Colthurst had no cash on the boat because he wrote a $100 check to a friend for cash so he could take his family out to dinner at Ruth Ann's restaurant in Craig to celebrate his 28th birthday. People at the restaurant later reported nothing unusual happened while the family dined, but one witness said John Kenneth Peel, remember this name, briefly stopped at the family's table to talk to them. Peel later denied he was ever at the restaurant. The Colthursts left the restaurant at approximately 9:30 p.m., and a crewman on the Decade remembered 4-year-old John sticking his head inside the pilot house to say hi on the way back to the Investor. That night, a storm with high winds and heavy seas pounded the dock, and the crew of the Decade celebrated the end of the salmon season with a loud party. With all that noise, no one on the Decade or Defiance heard anything unusual, and no one on either boat remembered anyone coming or going to the Investor. Now, remember, as I said before, anyone going to the Investor from the dock had to climb across the decks of those other two boats. Mm-hmm. At 6 a.m. on Monday morning, a Decade crewman went out on deck and saw the Investor slowly idling away from the dock. He noticed the crew of the Investor had inexplicably left their expensive tie-down lines on the deck of the Decade. Normally, the crew would retrieve these lines and stow them on board until they were needed again. The Decade's crewman waved at a man in the Investor pilot house, and the man returned the wave. A few minutes later, the Decade skipper also came out on deck and saw a man on the deck of the Investor. At 7:30 a.m., a crewman on another vessel saw the Investor anchored across the harbor from Craig near Fish Egg Island. What a name for an island.
Fish Egg.
Oh, we're just going to camp out on Fish Egg Island. Around that same time, another witness saw the skiff from the Investor tied to the cold storage dock in Craig. So they saw a man. They waved to him. He waved back. They saw the ship kind of idling, which they thought was strange for an experienced ship to be doing. And then later they saw it tied to a cold storage dock. All this, according to what I've read, is not usual behavior for an experienced ship and crew. By 10:30 a.m., heavy fog rolled into Craig, obscuring the investor from everyone in Craig. As the fishing fleet prepared for the salmon opening later in the day, the investor was forgotten for the moment. I mean, it was payday. Nobody's thinking about the investor and its weird ship habits. The investor, however, was way out in cold storage dock and had to be moved several times during the day. That doesn't make sense to me. Like, it had to be moved, but how did they move it? Did they not notice there was nobody on board? I'm not sure how that, that doesn't make sense to me, and I couldn't find out any elaboration. The captain of the Decade thought the investor left dock because of the loud party on his boat, and he radioed the investor to apologize. There was no reply. As boats headed out for the salmon opening, the fog remained so thick, most captains had to use radar to navigate. Tuesday morning, one day later, the fog finally lifted, and observers in Craig were surprised to see the investor still anchored near Fish Egg Island. Why didn't the Colthurst go fishing with the rest of the fleet? Later, a young man was seen buying 2.5 gallons of gasoline in Craig, and he then climbed into the investor's skiff with the gasoline and motored out to the investor. At 4 p.m., the crew of the fishing boat, the Casino, noticed smoke rising from the investor. After alerting authorities, the Casino headed toward the investor to offer help. On the way, the captain of the Casino saw the investor's skiff leave the investor and motor toward Craig, so like their little lifeboat. Mm-hmm. The captain nearly had to ram the skiff to make it stop. And when he asked if there were people on the burning boat, the skiff operator said, "Yeah, there's people on the boat," and then sped off toward Craig. Once the mysterious man in the investor's skiff reached the Craig dock, he spoke to at least 3 people before he walked into town and disappeared with the fog. A state trooper investigator later said the man slipped into a time warp at the end of the dock. So it's like one of those scary movie scenes where the guy just kind of walks off and disappears off screen.
Oh, wow.
Weird.
Yeah. By the time the Casino reached it, the investor was fully engulfed in flames and too hot for the crew of the Casino to approach. Alaska State Trooper Bob Anderson was the first law enforcement official to arrive on the scene. No one in Craig had the proper equipment to fight a fire on the water, so the responders issued a mayday call, and nearly 2 hours later, a tugboat with one very small pump arrived and started spraying water on the blaze. The Coast Guard was contacted to airlift additional pumps to the scene. Trooper Anderson returned to Craig and called his sergeant in Ketchikan, telling him the fire was spreading so quickly he was sure the blaze was arson. His sergeant said he would send an arson investigator to the scene. At 7:30 p.m., the tugboat captain radioed the Coast Guard to tell them the fire was under control. Anderson returned to the investor and found it burned basically down to the bones of it. Like, all you could see were the foundations of it. He and a few volunteers boarded the wreckage and found the charred human remains of 4 people in what had been the galley of the boat. The remains were later identified as Mark Colthurst, his wife Irene, their daughter Kimberly, and Mark's cousin Mike Stewart. All 4 had multiple gunshot wounds. As soon as the 4 bodies were removed, the fire flared up once again and destroyed the rest of their cabin. Anderson returned to Craig, where a police officer told him he had interviewed a witness who saw a suspicious man in the investor's skiff. The witness said the man was 20 or 21 years old, with light brown or blonde hair. He weighed 150 to 160 pounds and was wearing glasses and a baseball cap with a logo on it. Since the man was seated in the skiff, the witness couldn't guess at his height. The following morning, 2 more law enforcement officials arrived. The fire was still burning. so the troopers finally summoned a helicopter used for fighting forest fires, and it dumped water on the burning boat. The boat was burning so badly, the officers towed it ashore and left it there until the arson investigator could examine it. Oddly, the authorities left the investor unguarded, allowing anyone to poke around in the wreckage, and the rising tide likely most likely destroyed any remaining evidence. Once the arson investigator examined the wreckage, he found more bone fragments. Jerome Keown's remains were eventually identified among the fragments, but it was never determined whether the remaining bone fragments belonged to Chris Heyman, Dean Moon, and no remains were ever found of 4-year-old John Colthurst. Investigators believed his small body was completely consumed by the blaze. Can you imagine how hot that fire was to leave no evidence? There's, I mean, even with cremation, there's still fragments. That's just
crazy.
Yeah. Investigators did not think the killer was one of the missing crew members because eyewitnesses were certain the man they saw operating the skiff was not a member of the investor's crew. Since neither Chris Heyman nor Dean Moon was ever seen again after the fire, they were presumed dead, and the police determined that 8 people had been murdered on the investor.
How many of the crew members were missing?
So it was 3 total, but they found remains, and they assume those remains belonged to those 3, but they can't 100% confirm it because it was just bone fragments. And this is of note, this to this day is Alaska's largest unsolved mass murder.
Wow.
So there was an investigation and a trial, but they still, no one has ever been convicted for this murder. Police weren't able to extinguish the fire on the investor until a full day after it started. So by then, no forensic evidence remained, and troopers really couldn't even be certain how many victims had died on the boat. When the responding officer was informed that the skiff seen leaving the burning boat was tied to a cold storage dock, he examined it briefly, but decided the rain would have washed away any fingerprints, so he didn't even bother to impound the boat to look at it more closely. And this was the boat that the man who most likely murdered the family got away in. And they didn't even impound it to investigate or do any forensic detail on it.
Oh, wow. More bad police work.
Yeah.
Sounds about right for the stories we've covered.
Yeah, seriously. The only evidence the authorities had were the eyewitness descriptions of the man who bought the gasoline and sped away from the burning boat in the skiff. Considering the number of people who saw and even spoke to this man, you would think their descriptions would lead authorities to a suspect, especially since Craig is a town of only 1,200 people. Unfortunately, the descriptions of the suspect were vague. And he was so average looking that it described about 80% of the men in that town.
Was there a really bad composite sketch?
No, there was not a composite sketch.
Damn.
I looked so hard for you, Brandon, because I know that's your jam. So investigators believe the crew members of the investor were killed 1 or 2 at a time as they returned to the boat Sunday night. They determined that Mark, Irene, and Kimberly, that's the little girl, and Mark Stewart were shot with a .22 caliber weapon. They think the killing started not long after the Colthurst returned to the boat because Irene was found in the same clothes that she had been wearing at the restaurant. The killer must have remained on the investor the entire night. The next morning, he ran the investor to Fish Egg Island, where he anchored it in deep water and opened the seacocks, expecting it to sink. So I guess that's like the little windows or whatever. I don't know what seacocks are. It sounds way more exotic than what it is, I'm sure. He almost certainly was surprised to see the investor still floating when the fog cleared, and that's when he purchased the gasoline and took the skiff back to the investor to set it on fire. It took over a year for investigators to suss out all the leads and come up with a suspect. And that is when they identified John Kenneth Peel, a Bellingham man who had once worked for Mark Holthurst, as the prime suspect. The authorities arrested him nearly 2 years to the day after the murders. And 2 years later, in January 1986, the trial proceedings began in Ketchikan, Alaska. Jury selection took more than a month, with prosecution and defense fighting over every juror. The animosity between the prosecution and defense carried over into the trial. And the case dragged on for 6 months, becoming the longest running trial in Alaska history. The Superior Court trial judge admonished both prosecution and defense for their backhanded and unprofessionalism. The state admitted they had only circumstantial evidence against Peel, and the evidence was either based on witnesses who said they saw Peel in the investor's skiff, or saw Peel purchase gasoline before the blaze started on the investor. The state said Peel's motive was revenge because Holthurst had fired him the previous year. And it should be noted that in my research, a lot of people said Mark Holthurst was very good at his job. He was a great captain. He was a great fisherman. He was a fair boss. But he was also very cocky, and he would often get in fights with people. So it could, that could be an easy motive that he and Peel had a disagreement, and then Peel was fired.
He could have made a crazy person mad.
Correct, yes. Peel's defense picked apart the eyewitness testimony, pointing out inconsistencies and making it clear that some of the witnesses had changed their stories or had trouble remembering the events from 4 years earlier. The defense also suggested these killings were a result of a drug deal gone bad, but the defense never introduced any drug evidence into trial. The defense also hinted that maybe another crew member could have been the murderer, since their remains were also never identified. After 6 months of testimony, the jurors deliberated 6 days before declaring themselves deadlocked. The jurors agreed not to talk to the press, but journalists reported they voted 7-5 for acquittal. 2 years later, the state brought Peel back to trial, and this time the trial was held in Juneau, Alaska. The second trial lasted only 3 months because the defense decided to call no witnesses. The jury deliberated 4 days and once again acquitted Peel of murder. The investigation and the trials cost the state nearly $3 million. Even after a jury acquitted Peel, state officials insisted Peel had murdered Mark Holthurst, his family, and crew. No one else has ever been charged with the massacre aboard the investor. In 1990, Peel sued the state of Alaska for $175 million for wrongful prosecution. In 1997, he agreed to a $900,000 settlement and then disappeared. There are some rumors. The authorities and the district attorney stated that early in the investigation, drugs were not involved in investor murders, but rumors flowed suggesting that there were drugs involved, and there were no foundations for this rumor. But it
just
seems,
it just feels like it would be, though, like the way it all turned out. So yeah,
right, yeah, it's almost like you see in Florida, you know, like on cop shows and stuff, when there's a drug wars going on, this is usually how they get rid of their competition.
Sounds like a lot of people died just for one person's, you know, attitude. Like, why would all those other people have to die if somebody was just going after?
Right, you know, right.
Mark, was his name Mark?
Yeah, yeah. This just seemed personal. I mean, to kill even the kids and the wife.
Yeah. And like waiting there one by one as they come in.
Yeah, I mean, that's personal. Another reason people thought it was drugs is because the Holthurst paid cash for their boat. But there is no no foundation for that. And let's see, two crewmen who worked with John Peel the year after the murders reported that he admitted to them that he had murdered the crew of the Investor, but their claims are also suspect.
That's a pretty crazy mass murder for an unsolved murder for so long for Alaska.
Yeah. I know. And
not just for Alaska, for anywhere, but.
Yeah. And to have so many witnesses and nothing come about.
Yeah, 8 people. Wow. Okay, we're going back to 1989 tonight with our true crime time machine. Louise from Twitter sent us 1989. And that's a pretty interesting year. We got a couple of well-known cases to talk about. And then we have one that's not so well-known, but I have a personal connection to it, as crazy as it sounds. So I'm going to start with that. And I'm talking about the Standard Gravier shooting. This happened in September of 1989 in Louisville, Kentucky. And the Standard Gravier building was a printing plant. And it was connected to the Courier Journal building, which is where I work, a newspaper, before, you know, I started working at home like most of the country, or a lot of the country. But on September 14th, 1989, 47-year-old Joseph Westbecker walked into the Standard Gravier building, his former place of work, and shot and killed 8 people and injured 12. He then turned the gun on himself. This shooting remains Kentucky's most deadly mass shooting to this day. Westbecker had been suffering from manic depression and was on Prozac. He had stated he was being treated unfairly by his employers and was eventually put on medical leave. During his time off, his anger was building up and finally ruptured when he was notified that the company was canceling his disability income. This set him off, and he went back to the printing plant with one goal in mind. He wanted to kill those who he felt had wronged him. He arrived at the building early that morning, took the elevator to the 3rd floor, which was the executive floor. He was going to go for the big guys. As soon as the elevator doors opened, he shot receptionist Sharon Needy and Angela Bowman. Needy died, and Bowman ended up paralyzed with a shot in the back. He then went searching for the company president, Michael Shea, and any managers that he could find. Along the way, Westbecker calmly walked through the hallways, deliberately shooting at anyone he could find. During the rampage, he killed and injured several more, but never found any of his targets. None of them were actually in the building at that time. He did spare one man during all of this. He encountered former colleague John Tingle, whom he had no issues with. So he said to the man, "Hi, John. I told them I'd be back. Just get away from me." He then walked away and continued firing his weapons. After about a half hour, Westbecker made his way back to the press room floor, where he then shot himself. Victims and families eventually sued the maker of Prozac. They claimed that that's what set him off finally. And it's kind of crazy. Like I said, I have a connection to this because I actually work in the building that was connected to the plant. They actually shared like a lot of common areas, including a cafeteria and the press room. So, and I worked with some people who were there that day. It used to be the Louisville Times and the Louisville Courier Journal. The Times was the afternoon paper, so people were there in the mornings at work when this happened. And one of my coworkers, she actually told me the story how, you know, they didn't know where he was going to go next, if he was going to come into their part of the building. So they all like hid under their desks, you know, just a typical office shooting situation, even before, you know, it's 1989. It's pretty early for that.
Scary.
But yeah, you're actually.
They heard the shots, or how did they know that?
They heard the shots, and, you know, they knew right away what something was going on. So they reacted how everyone probably would, I guess, and just started hiding. And that same coworker one time took me on a little tour of like, the building where he worked is no longer there, but the basement is under it, and you can get to the basement from my building. So she took me over there, and we kind of like walked his path along the way. Yeah, it's pretty spooky, especially under there, because you're basically like under the city at that point. And then you go into the press room where some of the shootings happened, and then up some steps to the mail room, and then into a break room where he shot some people in the break room, and before going back to the press room and shooting himself.
Oh my gosh. Do your coworkers, like, how did they handle that? Like, did they get PTSD, or did they have trouble going back to work?
Not really because they're all news people, and journalists are trained a certain, in certain things, and there's things, some things just don't, shake them, whether it's, that's why so many people can go cover wars and whatever. But, so I guess it's not, it could be, I'm sure it bothered some people.
I guess it's kind of like when medical workers, they have patients die and stuff. You just, it's part of the job, part of the environment. You just kind of have to soldier through, really.
Yeah, it's creepy. I actually went to the archives to look up some stuff, because I was pretty, that's just what we're all fascinated by this kind of thing. We don't want to glamorize it, but we want to read about it. And I read all about it, and I was like, checked out the photos, and I could see areas where I knew where the photos were taken. My coworker said there was like a stack, they had a stack of bodies out by the elevator that I took every day to my office.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And my dogs are sneezing, and I'm just sorry, everybody. They're just going crazy, and I can't help it.
You know what? It's cute. That's fine. We love it. Your story, especially you taking the tour, it just put me in mind, whenever we're allowed to travel again and congregate, we should do some dark tourism stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm all about that.
Because I really want to go on some, like in Savannah, they have pretty cool tours, or you can go on a Manson tour in California. We need to do something like that.
Well, when I lived in LA, I was still feeling like a tourist. I took one of the LA tours, and they went up by where Cielo Drive is, where what Sharon Tate was murdered. The house isn't there anymore, but it was cool to actually go up the street. So is that the
one we went on together? Or a different one?
I think this was a different one. I'm not sure. But this was like the Cielo Drive. Actually, it's like right up where B. Arthur's house was. So if you remember that, then maybe you were there. I don't remember. But
because I went on all the fun.
But it sucks that the house is no longer there. Some really ugly new mansion sits there now.
I mean, B. Arthur's house and Manson. It's like the perfect day.
Yes, exactly.
If you went and got ice cream afterwards, I would be hating you right now.
when I saw 1989, it escaped me that was the exact year. And so when I was like, okay, what happened in 1989? And I saw that pop up, and I was like, oh, I'm going to have to talk about this, because I worked there.
Yeah, definitely. That's crazy.
And the guy, he's buried in the cemetery. That's a pretty popular cemetery here. If like a lot of well-known people here are buried there, which I find surprising that he's buried there. I'm surprised he's not just somewhere unmarked or whatever, because he caused a lot of pain for a lot of people here. One thing that does happen is they definitely take everything in the building seriously. A couple years ago, some guy came dressed for Halloween in his Deadpool and had a fake gun on his side. And I was and he had his face covered. And I was actually about to get on the elevator with him, and I didn't. I went to the security, and I said, there's a guy dressed in like Deadpool, and he has a gun on his hip. And I know it's Halloween, but I don't think that's appropriate, especially here.
Yeah, and Halloween's your favorite holiday, so it's not like it was warranted at this point.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not a stick in the mud by any means, especially Halloween, but I was like, no, you're not going to come in here with a fake gun.
I think guns are kind of a done deal. Like, for Halloween, this point, guns shouldn't be part of the costume, I don't think.
I agree. That's why I was like, fuck it, I'm going to be a little narc and just go, I'm going to take care of this right now. So I don't know what happened. I'm sure they tracked him down, but his face was even covered, so I was like, no. So yeah. But a lot of other things happen in 1989, like the Menendez brothers murders.
Who?
My favorite murdering brothers.
Who are those guys?
Never heard of them.
Yeah, they haven't come up yet, which I'm no, actually they did. I remember you actually mentioning them at one time. But yeah, so, you know, we know a lot about them. I think everybody does. You know, on the night of August 20th in 1989, Jose and Kitty Menendez were shot and killed in their Beverly Hills home. And after 7 years, three trials, and thousands of hours of TV coverage, their sons Lyle and Eric Menendez were found guilty of the murders and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And, you know, along the way, the murders became one of the most famous criminal cases in the 20th century. And it was because it was a tale right out of, you know, Hollywood, literally. A rich couple killed by their sons, and court TV aired every second of the coverage. And why did they do it? Well, money, clearly. What was it, like 6 months, within 6 months after the murders, they had spent around $700,000, I think.
I mean, they were not wise with that windfall at all.
No, Lyle bought a Porsche, a Rolex, even bought a restaurant.
He bought a restaurant?
Yes. I don't know if it ever made it into operation, but he purchased it. I mean, I don't even, maybe it was already running even, I don't know. But
I'm just trying to imagine what type of restaurant Lyle Menendez would be into.
I know. I need to look that up some more. Now I'm really curious about it. Eric was a little more subtle. He bought a Jeep Wrangler and paid for a tennis coach, but he did go on a lot of vacations.
Gotta have that tennis coach with your blood money.
Yeah. And I mean, I think a lot of people suspected them, but there wasn't any evidence or anything. But then I think, was it Eric's psychologist told his girlfriend or his mistress? I read mistress. I'm not sure why, what that
story is. I think it was his mistress.
Yeah. And then she tipped off the police. So he broke the patient doctor confidentiality by telling his mistress, but he didn't.
Yeah. He actually broke the law in doing that too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know that happens a lot with psychologists. Like they're told things
and
that are quite illegal.
Yeah. And there is a loophole where, you know, you can get a warrant. If they have committed a crime or they are saying they're going to commit a crime, you can report that. But it's a very fine line and you have to be very careful how you go about that.
Yeah. So, and their defense was that their father had molested them, correct? Is that, I think so.
Yes. They said it was revenge and then they killed their mother because she knew about it and did nothing.
And the jury, some of the jury fell for that. And that's why the first trial was a hung jury. And then they were tried again and both found guilty. But wait, was there three trials though?
There were.
Were they tried together? Well, anyway, they were found guilty eventually. We all know that. We're not going on a deep dive on the Menendez brothers, but
that's another podcast entirely.
But and have they ever backed off on the abuse claims? I'm not sure.
No, they've never recanted those.
Yeah, so they're still going with that, which I don't believe. They just wanted the money.
Let's see. Their last appeal was actually in 2005.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I know there was also something not too long ago where they brought them together. They were reunited.
Yeah.
For some reason, someone decided they wanted to be flashy and show them off on TV again.
Here it is. In late 2017, A&E aired a 5-part documentary. The Menendez murders, Eric tells all. Oh, never mind. That's not it.
Hey, we're just going off our minds and Google here. So
yeah, this is just purely discussional.
Time machine.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes my mind isn't the greatest time capsule. I do think the weirdest thing to me that came out of this, I mean, obviously, besides the shooting of your parents, all of these women who became fangirls of them. Like, they're as popular as, you know, Brad Pitt, Tom Cruise, you know, of the time. I mean, it's crazy to me.
Yeah, that's always been something that fascinated me in a weird way, like how that happens.
Yeah, I want to know what it is that these women are attracted to. I mean, psychologically speaking, I'm sure it's a goldmine of research. And that is something I would love to do a mini episode on one day, where we just discuss, you know, women who are into murderers.
Yeah, we touched on it on our our Richard Ramirez documentary that I'm pretending like we've already recorded, because this will air after that does. So
yeah, because he got a ton of stuff, and you know, in that that Netflix special, it showed those pictures, and I was like, "Well, I'll be."
If that is all, if that's like the main thing that the public knows about someone, and they're getting like adoration letters and love letters and nude pictures, get help, sis.
Yeah, exactly.
I know. I mean, well, and TLC, you know, our favorite network, actually has a reality show, Love After Lockup.
Oh yeah.
And that's all it is people reuniting with their people they met on like prison pen pal sites and stuff.
Yeah.
Which is another thing we should watch and discuss one time.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, we definitely have to have a whole episode about hybristophilia is what it's called, I think.
That's a good name for it too.
Yeah. So the Menendez brothers, you know, has been a recent series, a recent documentary. You know, it's always going to be covered, it seems.
Yeah, and I mean, it's fascinating. I remember as a kid, just, you know, like Barbara Walters every day and the Menendez brothers, like it was a constant.
I feel like Oprah talked about it a lot too.
Oh yeah, they made the rounds.
Maybe she didn't. I feel like she did, though.
Oh, I'm sure she did. I would bet she did. One of the things I remember is when they revealed that one of them had a wig, who wears a toupee. And
yes.
They, like, one of his police photos, he was bald and people were confused.
Yes. Oh my gosh. That's like the greatest wig scandal since Andre Agassi revealed he wore wigs.
Oh, yes. And, you know, since they had money, it was a really good wig. So, but, yeah, so that's Menendez Brothers. And the last one we want to talk about from 1989, well, the last main one, is Eileen Wuornos committed her first murder. So in 1989, November 1989, her first victim was Richard Charles Mallory. And he was 51. He was a Florida electronics store owner, but he was also a convicted rapist. And she claimed that she killed him in self-defense because he tried to rape her. Of course she was a prostitute, and he picked her up, but, you know, that doesn't give anybody the right to rape somebody. So she claimed that it was, you know, in self-defense. And so that kind of sparked, you know, then her killing spree. Now, he's the only one that died in 1989, but after that, the killings continued in 1990, where she claimed six more victims. And in January 1991, she was arrested and she confessed to the murders, and she claimed that, you know, all the men had tried to rape her and that she had killed them all in self-defense. And she was tried for like every murder, I think. So she was found guilty multiple times and received six death sentences, which, you know, is just kind of crazy when you think about it just a little bit, because she's a woman, which is a rare for serial killers anyway. And she claimed that they were all, you know, self-defense. You know, men had wronged her entire life. You know, she'd been raped as a child, and, you know, and I mean,
sis just snapped.
Yeah, and so the fact that, you know, she got like six death penalties, it just felt like a little excessive to me, despite what she had done. I don't know.
I mean, it's no pun intended. It was overkill.
Yeah. And she protested it all. You know, like we talked about in our Death Row Meals podcast, she refused her final meal because of the way she was treated in prison. And she, one of the most interesting things that I know about this case is her final words were, I would just like to say, I'm sailing with the rock and I'll be back like Independence Day with Jesus. June 6th, like the movie, Big Mother Ship and all, I'll be back, I'll be back. So are those lyrics? I'm not sure, but I've never looked beyond that, but like, is that, it has to be a song, right? I'm not sure.
I just put it right on Hail Bop.
Yes. Oh my God.
And
go ahead, Brandon.
One of the documentaries I watched, she wanted a Carnival by Natalie Merchant played at her funeral. So I thought that was interesting too.
I think it's interesting because you kind of feel pity for her. You know, her first murder, she in fact killed a known rapist. So it's like a Dexter thing going on. She's a serial killer, but yeah, she kills bad people. But then also she scored a 32 out of 40 on the psychopathy checklist.
Yeah.
For being a psychopath.
Yeah, I think she maybe killed the first guy in self-defense, and she may have even had her own little form of post-traumatic stress and just killed any guy that she was alone with after that for no reason, or who knows.
I mean, no doubt her doing that type of work, she was picking up some men that were abusive, and probably some did try to rape her or rape her. But it just seems unlikely that every single person would have done that.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and then afterwards she would rob them, drive around in their cars.
Yeah.
So then it's like, okay, how calculated was it? Was it, I mean, so it's always up in the air. Like you have, on one hand, you have this sympathy for, and then on the other hand, you're like, oh my God, she is terrifying.
Yeah. And Monster, the movie with Charlize Theron, who she won, you know, she won the Oscar for playing her, is like my favorite comedy. Like it's not supposed to be a comedy, but I find it so fucking funny. Like, it's like I repeat lines from it. Like I killed a fucking John, and like it gets just in my head all the time because it's so silly. But it's, you know, it's also good.
I haven't seen that since it was new, but
my God,
I love that movie. We should have a rewatch one night.
Yes. And just the way she's like combing her hair in the bathroom, like slicking it back, getting good, like cleaning up, taking a what they call a whore's bath in the bathroom. Oh, gosh. Like getting pretty.
Saying how they made her look so much like her.
I know. And she nailed it. Like she nailed it. Like I don't separate them when I think about Eileen now. I see them both.
No, I'm picturing, ever since we've been talking about her, I've been picturing Charlize.
Yes. So good. But yeah, Monsters, if you haven't seen it in a while or ever seen it, it's definitely worth a watch. And it's pretty accurate. They didn't totally change it like they often do.
They didn't really need to. I mean, it just wrote itself.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So and she's the most famous female serial killer, right? Those are very, very rare.
I think that one gets a hearty recommendation from all three of us, right?
Yes.
Definitely.
And this isn't the first time we mentioned 1989 during our podcast. We've already covered one horrible event from that year, right, Derek?
Oh, yes, the Amy Mihaljevic case. That was also 1989.
Yeah.
Amy, the little girl, trigger warning, by the way. Excuse me, the little girl in a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio, that was lured to an outdoor shopping center and then led away by a man. Later, her remains were found. Excuse me. That was in 1989.
Yeah, so listen to that episode if you haven't yet.
Speaking of abductions and trigger warnings and 1989, there was also a case that got some attention because it was around the time of Amy Mihaljevic. Actually, if I'm remembering the dates correctly, I think it was just before Amy's case. In fact, this case would have probably gotten more attention if Amy's wouldn't have happened just right after. But there was a young boy, and again, trigger warning with this story. But there was a young boy named Jacob Wetterling. He lived in Minnesota, And on October 22nd, 1989, it was a Sunday, just after 9 p.m., Jacob, who was 11 at the time, was with his younger brother, Trevor, his friend, Aaron. They were all 10 or 11 years old, biking home from a convenience store in Minnesota where they had gone to rent a movie back in the going to the stores to rent a video days.
Those days, yeah.
When a man that we now know is Danny Heinrich, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, approached the boys wearing a stocking cap mask, and he was armed with an unloaded revolver. He came out of a driveway and ordered the boys to throw down their bikes and to lay face down on the ground. He then asked each boy his age. Jacob's brother was told to run to a nearby wooded area and not to turn around and look at him or he would be shot. And then Heinrich demanded to view the faces of the two remaining boys. He picked Jacob and told Aaron to run away. And you get what happened after that.
Ugh. So he was like sizing them up.
He was sizing them up and he wanted to know their ages. And then he looked at their faces and he chose Jacob.
I wonder how old the other boys were too young for him or something. Or
they were all about the same age. Jacob was 11. His younger brother, Trevor, was 10. And their friend was 11. So they were all about the same age. Who knows what his weird criteria was. But
yeah, who knows?
That was a very sad. Actually, when I was trying to think of what case I was going to do before I decided on Amy, this one had popped up a couple of times. And I thought about doing this one. But since it was a solved case, I went with the Amy story.
Yeah, at least you got to mention it now. Anytime we can mention a victim's name, makes me feel better just to get their names back out there again.
And it was a long time before there was any justice in his case, wasn't there?
There was. I don't remember how. Oh, wow. It was way longer. I forgot. Let me see when that was, actually.
It was 2016.
2016?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So like a really long time.
Yeah, they recovered human bones from a pasture near Painesville, Minnesota, which was about 30 miles from his abduction site. And Heinrich also in 2016, he confessed to kidnapping and murdering him. And he confessed to that so he could make a plea deal because he wasn't really on the radar, I guess, but they found a bunch of child pornography in his house. And then he was like, okay. And he made a plea deal, but he also was not convicted because of the statute of limitations, but he is also guilty of assaulting another young boy prior to Jacob.
He's that in boy, prison, right?
Yeah. And okay, that boy lived, but it was the same MO. That boy and another boy were out. He told the older boy to run and not look back, and he abducted and assaulted this little boy, Jared Sherrill, who actually lived. And but by the time they found this guy, the statute of limitations was up. He did get convicted on child pornography charges and the murder, because murder has no statute of limitations, of Jacob. So that's, I mean, I'm glad there's some justice, but it took a really long time.
Really long time.
Yeah, too long.